Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June the 11th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Chuck Huff, continuing his series on psych fallacies. Today's session is entitled, I Am Not a Racist. Let's listen in.
My name's Chuck Huff. This is second in a series of sessions on psychological fallacies. The particular fallacy that we want to talk about today is, I put it up on the board as, I am not a racist, by which I didn't mean me, but I meant in general the thought that we're not prejudiced. And what I wanted to talk about today some was the structure of prejudice and how it's changed over the years. You see what I put up on the board are a variety of fill-in-the-blanks. For the folks on the tape, they are, blacks are fill-in-the-blank, Jews are, Christians are, Japanese are. And I wanted to put those up there just to prime in your minds the standard stereotypes that we have about various groups. Now, the fact that you can come up with a stereotype doesn't mean that you believe it, but it does mean that you're aware of it. So the stereotypes of what Jews are like have been relatively stable in the research since we started doing this work in the early 1900s. And a few things come in and fall out. Stereotypes of the Japanese, for instance, in the 50s, picked up the attribute of being copycats, and that part of the stereotype has dropped out now, because one of the things that Japan did in order to help jumpstart its economy was to copy a lot of products and to produce imitations of products. Now we imitate their products. But those stereotypes have remained fairly constant over the years that we've been looking at them. And it is one of the things I want to talk about is how those stereotypes influence us even though we may not believe them. I have two sort of basic theses that I'd like to convince you of in this session. One of them is that prejudice is basic to human nature. This is not good news. But I'd like
to go further.
Sure.
Would you define prejudice? To me, it means prejudging somebody without knowing. What is your description?
That's a fine description. That's one that will work. Judging someone. A definition of basing your judgment on a stereotype for prejudice. And it depends upon the kind of work that that the particular people are doing who are doing prejudice. But it usually always means judging people without evidence or with bad evidence. And we usually also assume that these are negative judgments. Other people like to include that these negative judgments have an emotional attachment for people. But I prefer not to talk about prejudice that way, partly because we can find some actions among people that are prejudice-like, even who on standard scales where we measure prejudice don't show up as prejudiced. And that's some of the stuff that I want to talk about. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just so we have some common ground in what prejudice is.
Yeah. Does that make sense to folks as a definition of prejudice? It's a broad and fuzzy definition, and I don't know that I can help you any more than to give you sort of the...
It can't necessarily be a negative thing.
Almost always, people talk about it as a negative thing.
Right.
Although, if you go back to the original roots of the word, it's just prejudging. That is, judging before you have enough evidence. And you could prejudge someone to be a wonderful person and then later find out either that you're right or wrong. But usually when we talk about prejudice, we're talking about negative stuff. A theological way to talk about this basic thesis is to talk about it in terms of original sin. Now, I'm not a good theologian, and so I'm not going to try to do it that way. Some of you who are might want to think about whether the kinds of things I'm talking about help people understand what it means, what original sin might mean. I'd like to suggest, and this really is only a suggestion. There's debate among social scientists. But I'd like to suggest that we are wired to be prejudiced. That is, neurologically, we're wired to be prejudiced. That doesn't mean that we're wired to be prejudiced against particular groups. It doesn't mean that we're condemned to act on our prejudices. But I think it does, but it does mean that prejudice is much deeper in us than we think it is. And that's part of why I say the statement, "I'm not a racist," is a fallacy, because things are much more complicated than that. Let me give you some of the areas of research that have talked about this basic root of prejudice. The minimal group studies that were first started in Britain took the field of social psychology by storm. Taj Fell and some others brought people into the social psychological laboratories, and they divided them up into different groups. They told them, perhaps I should spell his name for you, it's a funny name, Taj Fell. If you want to go look, T-A-J-F-E-L, if you want to go look his name up. Divided people up into groups based on really relatively silly criteria. So, for instance, they would have them look at different kinds of abstract art and divide people up depending upon whether they preferred Klee to Kandinsky. And I don't know really what either of those are. But I know there are some slight differences in the abstract art style. Or they would divide them up based upon whether they overestimated or underestimated the number of beans in a jelly bean jar. Or they would divide them up the simplest way based upon a flip of a coin and say, you're now in the X group and you're now in the W group. They would then give these people tasks to perform, sometimes having to do with dividing money up between the groups, sometimes having to do with making judgments about the individual characteristics of people in these groups, sometimes having to do with apportioning blame between groups depending upon the experimental scenario. So imagine this in your head. You've been brought into a lab and you've been put into a group for what seem entirely arbitrary reasons. Not, we would usually say, psychologically meaningful reasons. You're just over in that corner of the room. Sometimes when I do this exercise with students, I choose the people who sit in the front of the room versus the ones who sit in the back, or the ones who sit near the door versus the one who sit away from the door. What they found is that people, even in these minimal groups, there's hardly anything distinguishing the groups, prefer the group they're in. And they talk about the group that they're in as having better psychological characteristics than the group that they're not in. And when they divide money up, they will even go so far as to take less money if they can have more money than the other group. Let me do that again. They'll even go so far as to take less money if they can have more money than the other group. So we say to them, here's two choices. You can take $5 for your group and the other group can have $5. Or you can take $4 and the other group will get $3. People on average choose the $4 because they get to have more than the outside group, than the out group. These studies suggest that even based on these very minimal criteria, we make some judgments about the groups that we're in versus the groups that we're not in, us versus them. And we can talk about some of the psychological underpinning of that if you're interested. But it's there. It's also there in field studies. People who have done work with unions find that very often unions, there are strict stratifications among the trades. And people will prefer, if their trade is higher status than another trade, will prefer to take less money if it means they get more money than the people that they think they have more status than. Right, so they will prefer to hurt themselves in order to be better than those other people that they know aren't good as them, or whose work they know isn't as useful as theirs. The minimal group studies suggest that there's something really very basic about the way we perceive groups that makes us think that the group we're in is better than the groups we're not in. And so that's some of the evidence I have for this proposition that prejudice is basic to human nature. Let me give you another bit of research that's been done, this time at the University of Wisconsin. These researchers used what's called subliminal perception. Let me write that word up on the board for you. And it really does exist. Subliminal is margin. So it's just below the margin of what you can recognize. What we do when we do subliminal perception studies is we take words or pictures or images and we flash them on a screen, and we have machines that can flash them for only as long as 3 milliseconds, say, 3/1000ths of a second. That's very quick. And if you flash them at about the right rate, and I haven't done these studies in a while, but I think it's somewhere between 8 and 14 milliseconds is the margin of perception. And so that you can get it very close to the margin of perception, so people will say, I think I saw something, but I don't know what it was. And so they'll think they saw something, but consciously they can't say, I recognize that, I know what it was. What they would do is these researchers took the standard stereotypes that we have about different ethnic groups and would flash them up on the screen subliminally so that people couldn't see them but could almost see them. And so for blacks, they would do the standard musical lazy. I don't know what some of the other things are, but I know those two were in the stereotype for blacks. And then they would give them a story of a person called Donald who did some nice things and some bad things. And they asked them to rate Donald's character. What do they think about Donald, etc. Well, what they found is that if they got these words that were associated with the stereotype, they would rate Donald as a worse person than if they got what they called control words, which were neither, some, lots. You know, words completely unrelated to the stereotype. And so here these words had an effect, even though the people couldn't say they saw them. The words had an effect in their judgment because they knew the stereotype. All of us know the stereotype. That's why I put those up there and primed them for us. All of us know the stereotypes. They knew the stereotypes, and the priming that they got from the subliminally flashed words made them rate the person less well, think the person wasn't as good a person. This was true, by the way, regardless of whether on personality tests these people came up as racist or not, as prejudiced or not. People who were far on the end of completely unprejudiced still rated Donald worse after they got these cues. The social psychologists who've done this study and others now have picked up calling that automatic processing. That is, this is the kind of mental processes that we do automatically without any conscious control. If I ask you what the stereotype of blacks are, it springs to your mind, even though you may want to suppress it and disagree with it and say you don't like it. The opposite of automatic processes are what we call controlled ones. And that is processes that we intentionally initiate, like saying, no, I'm not going to think of the negative attributes of blacks. And so whenever we're under pressure, we don't have a lot of time to make a judgment, or we're emotionally cranked up making a judgment, we don't have a lot of energy to put into carefully considering the judgment, or when the evidence is really ambiguous, these automatic processes have more power. So, for instance, I don't know if any of you have ever seen professional interviewers flip through resumes. It's frightening. Oh, gosh, they go through resumes like, one about every 4 seconds. This is an impoverished environment to judge people in. Well, they've got 350 resumes to flip through, and so they've got to screen through. And in those kinds of impoverished environments where you don't have very much time, you're under a lot of pressure, you've got to get something done, these automatic processes have more control over what we do, and they're more likely to influence us. Now, you see what I mean by it being a little more like original sin? It's perhaps when we're down, when we're at our worst, when we're not doing our best to think carefully, that the prejudice, that the stereotypes that we think of are able still to affect us, even though we don't know that they are. So that's the first thing that I wanted to make. First point that I wanted to make. The second point is that modern prejudice is much more subtle than we're used to. Give you a short description of one of my favorite studies in social psychology. This is a study looking at people's prejudiced attitudes about people who are handicapped. In this study, they brought subjects in to be in the study and asked them, said that the things weren't set up quite right, but if they go down the hall and take a right, they'd find a waiting room where they could wait for 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes, while they get the study set up. And of course, as you know by now, if you've heard me talk about social psychological studies, what was really going on was the study was in the waiting room. The waiting room was set up, it was fairly large, and it was set up with two televisions, with two sets of chairs in front of each television. Sitting in front of one of the televisions was a person in a wheelchair. The other television didn't have anybody in it watching it. The experimental conditions were whether the televisions were playing the same or two different programs. What they found is if the televisions were playing the same program, people would sit with a handicapped person. If the televisions were playing two different programs, people would sit away from the handicapped person and watch the other program, regardless of which program it was. They switched all of that, and whether it was left or right, and all of those things. Yes?
I'm just curious, why wouldn't it depend upon what you wanted to watch? Maybe if the handicapped person were watching something by him or herself that you didn't enjoy, you'd go to the other one.
Right, and
how could they tell why you went to...
What they did is they would flip which... Depending up, they would flip the programs. So they showed that it didn't depend upon the content of the programs. Well, no, not in the middle of watching, but across all subjects. So sometimes if you had program A and B, and the wheelchair person was watching program A, sometimes the wheelchair person would be watching program B. So he wasn't the wheelchair person in the wheelchair wasn't constantly watching the same program for every subject. Yes.
Did they do the same control with a person non-handicapped sitting in front of the program? so that you could tell if it was just because somebody was sitting alone in there, mm-hmm. or if it really had something to do with the handicap issue.
Or the program.
Well,
because my feeling is if the programs are the same and somebody's sitting in there, you feel like you need to sit and be with that person. It'd make no sense to go someplace else regardless. Mm-hmm. But if the program is different and you have a choice of being by yourself or right. sitting with someone.
Right, yeah, and they had that control in there.
They did.
Yeah, and what they found was that it then became much more random. People sometimes sit away and sometimes not. But they would much more reliably sit away when it was a handicapped person, and they had what we now call attributional ambiguity.
I think I have that.
If it was possible, excuse me.
I was just asking if she suffered from attributional.
Yeah, I think I do have that.
It does sound like a disease, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Don't come to me for help.
And attributional ambiguity is that if it's possible for people to not really be clear about why it is that you're making the judgment that you make, mm-hmm. then you are more likely to make a prejudiced judgment.
Say that again.
If it's possible for people to not really be clear why you're making the judgment you're making, then you're more likely to make a prejudiced judgment.
Like,
that's what the person.
Program,
if it's a different program.
If you were going over there just to watch that program, or if you just did not want to sit with the handicapped person.
That's right. And what you can say, and what people, and by the way, attributional ambiguity works as a way to fool yourself, too. People are often unaware of the prejudices that they show. So it's not that they're being sneaky and don't want anybody else to know, but it's also that they don't want themselves to know. And so if you come in the room and there's another program on, you feel like, oh gosh, I can go over there and sit over there where I'll just feel more comfortable over here. And gosh, isn't that program interesting? Whereas if the same program is on both televisions, it's going to be obvious that you're trying to sit away from this person. And so you don't have any attributional ambiguity.
So these persons know they were being watched, or are they...
No, they don't know they're being watched.
So it's the reaction of the person in the wheelchair to which they're...
Or perhaps their own reaction to themselves.
Okay.
Because we are always watching ourselves.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wherever
you go, there you are.
I said there are some people who don't like television... And made, what if they went up and turned off the set or went someplace and were reading or something?
Yeah, well, they controlled for all of those things. They made it impossible to turn the set off and made sure that people left their books somewhere else. But the odd thing that you find is people sit away from a handicapped person on average. But only if they get attributional ambiguity. Only if they can. Only if it's safe to sit away from them. Let me give you a couple of other examples of how attributional ambiguity works.
Have you thought about putting on the right side of the board? Social scientists are
sure
blank.
Social scientists are obscure. Social scientists love jargon.
Judgmental, controlling.
Lie a lot. This is not a study. Yeah, I promise. Sure.
You want us to all sign a waiver?
Yeah. That's right.
Always exceptions.
See, what was the other one? Ah, yes. In this study, They had people reading resumes. And they were resumes from people who were either black or white. And the resumes had been already judged in quality to either be of average quality or of really excellent quality for the position. So they brought people in, they gave them these resumes and had them read through them, make judgments about whether they should hire the person. What you find is for the really excellent resumes, they judged the black person to be slightly more qualified than the white person, and all at the upper end of the scale. You know, the standard way we do these studies, they're really the same resume. All you do is change the... and in fact, we can now, because we have these cool photographic techniques, change the race of a person without... and have still have the same person there. So we can make their nose a little wider or a little more narrow and change their skin color. But for the average resumes, you had attributional ambiguity, right? Because there were some good things and there were some bad things. And the black person was rated worse than the white person with the average resumes. Does that make sense? In terms of attributional ambiguity, when it's possible for you to sort of hide behind the oddities that are going on. And what social scientists do is they find these patterns by finding them averaged over a whole bunch of people. And so we're able, because of these experimental techniques, to smoke out what we call modern racism. That is much less evident than it used to be in the 1930s. In the 1930s, about two-thirds of the U.S. population thought that it was bad to have integrated schools. That has changed now so that only 2% of the population will answer that on a survey. That change has been even more dramatic in the South, only because in the South, the attitudes in the 1930s were more polarized. And so if you've got average resumes, you have attributional ambiguity, and your stereotypes can kick in and can work. And there's nothing that flags you to say, ooh, maybe I'm wrong about this person. And what flags you here, what flags you on the excellent resumes is, of course, gosh, these people are really great. I can't be wrong. This person can't be lazy. Not intelligent.
That model rings true to me about different characteristics as well. For example, I think it has to do with what your experience or your expectation is of a person.
Mm-hmm.
Like in our society, we expect that the mother is the prime caretaker of the child.
That's
that
right.
The woman does more cooking in the home.
That's
than
right.
The husband does. My husband likes to cook. We probably cook about the same amount, but because it's so unusual that a man likes to cook as much as he does, people think that he's an excellent cook.
Yes.
And that I probably
yes. Yeah, so you get that kind of a contrast effect. You get that kind of a contrast effect.
And the same goes with shared child care. When the dad is seen with the child, he gets all kinds of praise. Wow, what a great husband you must have that he spends so much time with the child.
And if the woman does the same, she's only coming up to what you're expecting anyway.
That's right, she ought to act that way.
I read an interesting article, not a social scientific study, but a theological article about an interesting form of this, I think, that is a little different. And that is young people who now are choosing to identify with an ethnicity that is not their own, but claiming its attributes, using makeup in such a way that they would look Hispanic when in fact they are not Hispanic.
Right.
Listening to music that would be associated with one group instead of the other. And the way it was written up in this article, it talked about a kind of deep, what probably is at its deepest level, prejudice, but becomes a sort of self-hatred, and that that we begin hating our own ethnicity because it, because somehow that's the reverse of what might be even deeper, which is fearing another's ethnicity. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And this, I haven't witnessed this phenomena. Where I have witnessed it, I think, is among straight people who will sometimes take on almost stereotypical attributes and affectations of gay people as a way of saying, see, I'm not afraid here, and I would rather associate with this community that feels more open and more loving and more receptive than my own community does. But mixed in that identification with a different group is sort of a rejection of yourself, which may oddly reveal a prejudice about the very group you're identifying
with. That you're identifying
with.
You know what I'm saying? That's right, because what you do is you use a stereotype of that group. Let me, and there's a fascinating effect that might help illuminate some of this. And this has been done over a whole variety of studies, and we call it the out-group homogeneity effect. Ooh, more jargon. Cool. People almost always think that they are more alike than we are.
They are more
what? Alike.
Okay.
For instance, if you look at this list, you've got lots of reasons to think Christians aren't anything. Because there's lots of different kinds of Christians that you run across. And only people who have a fair amount of experience with Jews or have read a lot know the wide variety of differences that there are amongst Jews. Or the wide variety of differences that there are amongst blacks. And so we find this in minimal groups, right? The ones where we divide people up, you get the same effect. So it's somehow psychologically meaningful to think that we have lots of variety, but they are all the same. And so when they want to identify with the other group, what they do is they pick up the stereotype, because to be a member of, to be a Hispanic, is to be like the Hispanic stereotype. Whereas if you're familiar with Hispanics, gosh, there's a wide range of people who are, and in fact, it's sort of hard to talk about them once you really begin getting close, because many of them don't like the label Hispanic, and they prefer some other label. Or no label at all. So the idea that the out-group is all alike and the in-group has a lot of diversity is based not only on your experiences, but it's also based on some need to see the in-group as better.
Well, part of what this article was saying is this was among young people, junior high school age people, who would, in a multi-ethnic environment in their high school, let's say, actually now had a chance to choose, in a sense, the ethnic group with which they were going to identify. And that part of that was a deep desire to belong somewhere, and to a person who wasn't in one of those, as you say, more what homogeneity. What was the phrase?
Homogeneous.
Out-group homogeneity.
Right.
That might, in fact, be a way of saying, well, if I identify with that group, I will belong there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I will have a sense of belonging that I don't seem to have in my own group, which I know is very diverse. And
you know, there is an interesting.
And it was, by the way, it wasn't just kind of Anglo folk, because there were crossovers among African Americans and Hispanics, and I mean
to become
just,
white and right.
Well, all over the way, but
right.
They were trying to decide whether this was a sign of a new level of acceptance. Or was it a new manifestation of just ongoing prejudice? That was what
I suspect that the answer is yes.
Both.
that in fact, obviously, 50 years ago, that sort of. Cross-identification would have been really looked down on because of strong attitudes that people had. And so there's clear advance in our society when people feel free to do that. But then some of our basic stereotypes show up when we do it. It is almost always the case that you get the bad with the good or the good with the bad intermixed. In those kinds of social. For instance, people talk about how computers are going to change the world and make us more democratic. Well, in fact, what we find out is that the very same kinds of effects that we find in the real world show up on the internet. Duh. Because there's people there, you know, and you get racial prejudice on the internet. And, well, it's because people do it. Yes?
I think it needs to be pointed out, at least I feel this is true.
Sure.
That prejudice is not just on the part of WASPs, you know, white Anglo-Saxons. Or
oh, no.
I mean, other ethnic groups have their prejudices, their prejudging of us, for example. And one dark-skinned group will dislike another dark-skinned group for whatever reasons.
And that's what I mean when I say it's basic to the human condition, mm-hmm. is that all of us are human and all of us have prejudice about outgroups. There's fascinating differences in the South, prejudices in the South among blacks regarding skin color, so that lighter-skinned blacks are thought of as more desirable and higher class than darker-skinned blacks. And that's true even today. Yes?
How is this basic prejudice, how does it affect multiracial people?
In this article I read, that was part of the issue, where kids who actually, like your son, will get to decide at some point which of his ethnic backgrounds he wants to identify more deeply with, or can he identify equally with both of them, or will people choose for him, or does he choose for himself? I mean, that was part of, because there are more people who have more options. And such
one of those
on a rational basis. I was just thinking about someone has, you know, three different racial backgrounds in their grandparents.
Yes.
Are they terribly confused about who they don't like? Or?
Well, you know, one of the ways that you need to look at that is within the context of the culture that they live in. So how it's going to affect them is going to depend upon how the society they're in defines racial divisions. So there are some societies in which if you have any admixture at all of black, you're black. And there are other societies in which that's not true. South African society has, as I remember, three different sort of levels. There's the colored and the black, and then whites. And I'm sure if you got closer, which I know you have, there's a whole lot more inside of those. Just like
English and Afrikaner among.
That's right.
There's the Indian and Cape colored or mixed race African.
That's right.
On the color.
And
the black, there's Zulu, Xhosa, Tswana.
And so you've got, and that society oddly enough, has a bit more complex understanding of race than our society does.
Because, but why is it that the blacks, and I'm using that
sure.
as a quote, who are maybe have 7/8 African or Negro blood, identify so strongly and are so prejudiced against whites when they're mostly white?
It is less a function of who they are than of who the society perceives them to be. And because the society perceives them to be black, they are forced to choose black. At least that's the way that I have seen it among many of these, you know, racially mixed individuals. At least in the United States, if you have any admixture of black at all, you're black. Just like in the South, if a slave and a free person had a child, the child was a slave.
It's been my experience that in the United States, race sensitive. But one area that just doesn't come up in conversation or in our consciousness, I think, is class.
Yes.
And a lot of times our opinions, I think, that we ascribe to races are really about classes.
Yes.
Or education.
Or education, which mixes in. And one of the things that you find is that provides us with some attributional ambiguity, either to do classist things or to do say racist things, is because the two do overlap so closely. One of the things that I wanted to suggest, based on a lot of this research and the distinction between automatic and controlled thinking about others, is that the way to counter prejudice isn't to try to make people not think prejudiced thoughts, which is what we often try to do.
Would you repeat that?
A way not to counter prejudice, or a way to try to counter prejudice and do it badly, is to try to make people not think prejudiced thoughts. Because what you'll find is that people will self-censor. They'll still maintain the prejudiced thoughts because we all have them. We all know the stereotypes, regardless of how prejudiced or not prejudiced we are, regardless of how closely it connects to us. And so what you end up doing is not thinking, is thinking that you're not thinking the thoughts, when in fact, if you're under time pressure or sometimes when there's attributional ambiguity, you end up doing it anyway. The right way, or shall I say, a more effective way to reduce prejudice is to train people to follow a scriptural injunction whose reference I can't remember. But I think it was Paul who said, I beg you in the bowels of Christ to consider that you may be wrong. And some of you who are Bible scholars can tell me why Christ's bowels had something to do with it. But yes, it's the King James Version, I think. The right way to get rid of the prejudice is to think again when we make a judgment. And so to allow ourselves time and to make sure that we allow ourselves time to check up on ourselves and make sure that we're not being prejudiced in our judgments. And so you go through the resumes and you sort them out by the way you think things go according to who looks good and who doesn't. And then you ask yourself, did I rank all of the women near the middle and bottom and not rank any women up at the top? Did I rank only white males at the top, and you go through and you look for that. So instead of saying to yourself, gosh, I'm not prejudiced, I think there are some really competent women, and then ranking the resumes and forgetting it and not checking, the way to do it is to consider that you might be wrong. When you make judgments about other people, go ahead and make the judgment, because you're going to anyway. And then go back and check up on yourself. It's a much more effective way of reducing prejudice. And I can send you back to the literature and show you that that works a whole lot better than simple exhortations to be fair. Yeah.
But that's not the general view now. You know, that's like admitting I'm wrong. Whereas if you say I'm not prejudiced, then it's, well...
Then it's not an issue. That's right.
You're not claiming it, so you don't have to deal with it.
That's right. That's right. And so it requires a kind of difficult humility to check up on yourself in this way. Because you say to yourself, gosh, it might be showing up. One of the nice things, I think, about the doctrine of original sin is that it provides us with a way to be humble about ourselves.
It's an excuse.
Yes. Well, it provides us with something that says we're all like this. It's not that I'm a bad person. It's that I'm a person. And all people prejudge others. It's just the way we're set up. So if you can think of it that way, instead of thinking that it's possible to be unprejudiced, and then see, this is the weird switch that I'm asking people to make, is to say, recognize that you are prejudiced, and then work to avoid letting that affect your actions, rather than striving to feel not prejudiced and finding out that prejudice sneaks in through the back door in a lot of these other ways that I was talking about. Does that make some sense? But it's hard to do, as you point out.
Oh, yeah. It's to me, it's a different way of thinking about it, to admit, be able to admit I'm prejudiced, and from the stuff you said earlier, that we're all coming from the same place. We're all prejudiced, committed to deal with it instead of, well, now, essentially denying it, I guess.
Instead of essentially denying. Now by saying we're all prejudiced, I don't mean that we are all as bad in our judgments about others as Ku Klux Klan members or really racist types. I mean, there are gradations of being prejudiced. What I'm suggesting is that you can't get to zero. You can have less or more, but you can't get to zero. Yes?
How do you figure in likes, dislikes, preferences, comfort levels?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been in positions where with a certain person, for example, I'm just not comfortable because of our own differences in what we like and what we like to talk about, or
sure,
educational level or whatever. And if that person happens to be of a different race, then obviously I'm a racist or I'm prejudiced. And I don't think I am, because what I'm based on is, me with my eyes closed, I can say, gee, I can talk comfortably with you. You're okay. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And this person, I can't. Well, it depends on what... It doesn't depend upon what color they are. There are other things that help us, or that force us, or make us, well, use whatever word
you want,
to evaluate that person. And I don't think it's always prejudice. I simply have to justify and defend myself in that area.
Well, we brought up one thing that it could be, and it could be socioeconomic status. It could well be. Well, for instance, I think that the reason that the noon on Sundays is the most racially segregated time in the United States is partly because of sheer racism, but it's also because of cultural differences. I enjoy worshiping at many black churches, but that's because I was raised, at least with one of my parents, as poor white trash. Right? And so I enjoyed a lot of things that other people didn't. And I had a very different cultural background, and I'm able to enjoy the more Pentecostal, revivalist kinds of services. I think it's important to distinguish that kind of comfort from racism. Yeah. But it's also very hard because, as you say, the two can serve as masks for each other. You have to be careful when you simply say, well, I feel uncomfortable. And you have to think again about yourself and say, is there a pattern in my comfort level that always seems to exclude blacks? Is there?
No.
Yes, and that's. But what I'm suggesting is that what we need to do is to continually ask ourselves that question instead of, and it's a way of asking, is this having an effect that I think would be morally wrong? By asking again, am I sorting people out on something? Or am I depriving them of something? I mean, one of the most difficult issues that I know of in hiring, and it happens at on college campuses all the time, is precisely this issue of comfort. People will say, gosh, I don't feel comfortable with them, and so I don't think they'd be as good a colleague as this other person, who often happens to be the white person who's a lot like them. And so obviously they feel more comfortable with them. And you have to ask yourself, well, is comfort the right criterion? And how much, and that's a very complex question. And I don't have easy answers to it.
Depends on how closely you have to work with that person.
That's one of the things it depends on, yeah.
And how much each one is able to grow or change.
And whether, in fact, one of the things you might like to do in your work is make yourself less comfortable. And some organizations would like to become less comfortable so that they can learn new and different things. Because learning new and different things always makes us less comfortable.
Depends on what you describe as comfortable.
Yes.
To me, it's ability to talk whether you agree or disagree. But comfortable to me is being open and forthright and honest. And then you can disagree all you want.
And so a lot of it depends, again, on how we use the ambiguity in the situation. And what I'm suggesting is that the ambiguity needs to be looked at very cold-heartedly. And so that we say to ourselves, am I hiding behind the ambiguity in this situation? Or is, in fact, my judgment not based on prejudice? Well, why don't we close with those seeming words of wisdom? Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.